Today is Monday, May 15th. This is the first day of class. Okay, so there are two ways to maintain homeostasis. These are called feedback mechanisms. And these feedback mechanisms are going to try to restore some kind of order in the body. They're different, though, in how they achieve this. There is a negative feedback mechanism that is the most common way for us to achieve homeostasis in the body. And then just a few mechanisms are restored by positive feedback. So we'll talk about some examples of each feedback mechanism. Okay, so we're keeping in mind our goal. Our goal is to achieve some type of balance or equilibrium in our bodies. That's what we think of as homeostasis. And we're going to talk about ways to achieve that kind of balance or equilibrium. Which of these two is the most common method used by the body?
Negative.
Good. So with negative feedback, our goal is to stop something from happening. And you're oftentimes going to hear the word inhibit. We're going to inhibit or stop or cancel something from happening that's causing our bodies to leave our homeostatic range. So let's talk about body temperature for an example here. If you're outside on a really hot summer day, we're getting there, aren't we? 90-something degrees today. That heat is going to cause your body temperature to increase. So how do you stop that increase in body temperature?
Sweating.
Good. Likewise, go the other end of the extreme. If you're out on a really cold winter day, 20 degrees, what's going to happen to your body to get your body temperature back up?
Shivering.
Right. So the goal here is to stop what's causing trouble in terms of maintaining homeostasis, and we're going to cancel or stop or inhibit that process. So that's kind of what we're looking at with a negative feedback loop. All right, I'm just checking to see if anybody still needs a screen. So let's take that example of a hot summer day and work it through as a negative feedback mechanism. A typical feedback loop is going to have 5 steps to it. We're going to start with the stimulus, which causes a change in your internal environment. So the stimulus, we said, was going outside on a hot summer day. Okay, so simply having heat is going to be our stimulus. The next step is a sensory receptor, and sensory receptors pick up on information around your body, not just inside, but also outside your body. They're tattletales, and like tattletales, they always run and tell on you. They tell mama what you did, right? So these tattletales are going to tell your brain what's happening. What message do you think these sensory receptors have? Your body's overheating, exactly. So these sensory receptors are like tattletales. They're going to tell your brain that you're overheating. Sometimes your brain is going to be the control center, and we think of that as a regulatory center. It's not always going to be your control center. Sometimes an organ can be a control center like the pancreas. Or even your spinal cord can be a control center. But in this case, your hypothalamus in your brain is the control center for body temperature regulation. So the brain receives that sensory information. So what message does your brain get? You're too hot, right? And what does your brain say we should do about this problem? Sweat. Yeah, sweat to cool down. Exactly. So the regulatory center receives the input of information from your sensory receptors. That is, your regulatory center gets the message, it's hot and we need to cool down. So how do you get the message out to your sweat glands? Yeah, motor nerve good. So that motor output pathway takes information from your brain to your sweat glands with one message. To do what? Sweat. Good. All right, so the motor output carries a message from your brain. Carries a message from your brain to your sweat glands. And the message is to sweat. So this term effector here is important for us because the effectors bring about an effect that will cancel the stimulus. In other words, the effector is going to cancel, inhibit, or stop what's causing us to have a problem in the first place. So what is our effector in this example? Sweat glands release sweat. And as long as you sweat, that evaporative cooling occurs when sweat leaves your skin surface, giving you a much cooler body temperature. Okay, so the effectors are your sweat glands. They release sweat to cool your body temperature down. Can you tell me what the relationship is between the effectors and the stimulus in a negative feedback loop? Good. One's an input, the other is an output. So when you go back to our original issue here, the output is your effector. What was your input?
The stimulus.
Good. I wouldn't memorize this little phrase, but it does summarize for us what's happening. The output or the effector is what's going to inhibit, cancel, or stop the stimulus or the input. So that's what we're trying to do with negative feedback. We're trying to tweak everything back into a narrow range of values. We know that body temperature for most of us averages around 98 degrees. So that's what we're trying to do, is kind of nudge that body temperature back to where it belongs. So by stopping the heat issue, then we have effectively canceled that input. Okay. So a few minutes ago, we talked about what happens when you're cold. Can you tell me the effector when you're cold?
Shiver.
Yeah, what shivers?
Muscles.
Yeah, your muscles shiver. Good. So your muscles shivering has what effect on the stimulus? Yeah, stops the cold, it warms you up. Exactly. So it works against that input, which is being too cold. Good. Okay. Other examples of negative feedback control are things like heart rate, blood pressure, respiration rates. These are all going to be something we discuss in Bio 211. So a lot of our body systems are regulated through this negative feedback loop. Let's contrast this with a positive feedback loop. Positive feedback works to enhance or increase the input. How is that different from negative feedback? Yeah, negative wants to stop the input or cancel it. Positive feedback aims to enhance or increase the input. Let me make a point here about positive feedback. It does not aim to get you back into a narrow range of values. It is not nudging you back toward what your body says is normal. With positive feedback mechanisms, we're trying to achieve something. Babies being born, this operates by positive feedback. Milk production during breastfeeding is positive feedback. Even having a bowel movement is positive feedback. So we're not necessarily trying to nudge your body's values back into a narrow range. We're trying to accomplish something which ultimately restores normal order or homeostasis within your body. So oftentimes we describe homeostasis as maintaining a narrow range of values, but in terms of positive feedback, that's not what we're trying to achieve. So the goal here is to enhance or increase what's happening, and like I said, it's to achieve some goal, such as producing a bowel movement, or to continue producing milk for a baby who is breastfeeding. So let's talk about oxytocin. This is probably our best example of a positive feedback mechanism. Oxytocin is a hormone produced by a female's brain. When a baby is being born, oxytocin travels through the bloodstream and the nervous system to target a female's uterus. What does oxytocin tell the uterus to do?
Contract.
Good. What does this help us do?
Have a baby.
Have a baby. Push it out, right? Okay. Let's think about it this way. If it was negative feedback, every time oxytocin was produced and the uterus contracted, what feedback would go back to the brain?
To stop it.
Nobody who's ever had a baby wants that to happen, because you don't want the process to slow down. You want the process to carry on, speed up. So we want this to be an enhancement or an increasing process. So the feedback message from the uterus to the brain is, hey, that worked, do it again. So this time, the brain releases more oxytocin. The next contraction is even harder, and that means that we're getting closer to producing a push that can get the baby out of the birth canal. So this time, what message goes back to the brain over a positive feedback system? Stop it or do it again?
Do it again.
Do it again. So what eventually is going to halt this positive feedback mechanism? When the baby's born, yeah. So the goal is to continually enhance oxytocin. That will continually enhance uterine contractions. And the goal is to produce a baby pushed out of the birth canal. Childbirth is accomplished when you increase oxytocin and the contractions. So when we go back and look at this example here, output enhancing input, or output as it may be, what would you say that oxytocin enhances?
Contractions,
yeah, childbirth. And what would you say contractions enhance?
Delivering the baby.
Delivering the baby, and even more production of?
Oxytocin.
Yeah, oxytocin. So you can see that one feeds off of another, and it just becomes this who-can-top-who relationship between oxytocin and the contractions. And finally, when the baby is born, then we're back at what we consider to be a homeostatic state. Okay, so totally different from the negative feedback mechanism. What is the goal of the effector in that mechanism? Sure. The goal of a negative feedback mechanism, what is the goal of the effector?
To stop.
Yeah. The goal of the effector with a positive feedback mechanism is to
continue.
Right. So by far, negative feedback is the way we maintain narrow range of values, like body temperature in our bodies. But there's a handful that we do discuss, like blood clotting, bowel movements, breast milk production, and birthing babies. They all fall into that positive feedback loop. So we'll discuss these as we work through both Bio 210 and 211 when the occasion arises. I just wanted to make sure you'd have that page. That is page 2 in your course pack. Do you have any questions, anything I can clarify on that page? All right, let's talk about chemistry. And chemistry begins on page 4 of your course pack. Okay, So you may wonder why we're having this discussion about chemistry when this course is about anatomy and physiology. A lot of our conversations in terms of how your body works actually boils down to chemistry issues. When we talk about how muscles contract and how nerve impulses are sent, it's all a basis of chemistry. So we want to lay enough of a foundation here so we can have that conversation. Let's first of all talk about matter and elements about midway down your page. How would you define matter? Good. Has mass and takes up space. So are we matter?
Yes.
Yeah, we matter, right? Okay. Yeah, we've got matter. The air you breathe is matter. Okay, in fact, everything on Earth is considered to be matter, except for those things that exist in a true vacuum. But for the most part, we can say that what is on Earth is matter. So matter is composed of elements, and elements are building blocks of matter. In fact, elements have their own building blocks, these tiny little particles called what?
Atoms,
good. So atoms of the same type will compose an element. So I'd want to spend a few minutes talking about atoms in just a moment. So we're not going to talk about every element on this periodic table. We're only going to talk about a select few. The select few are listed in the chart near the bottom of your page. You'll want to mark the top four. The top four are oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. You'll want to mark the top four, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. They made it easy on us. The symbols are the letters of the first of those element names. So, of course, oxygen has a symbol of O, carbon is C, hydrogen is H, and nitrogen is N. Now, you can rearrange the letters and get CHON or HONK. Either way, you can remember the top four, but oxygen is our most common element. And that may come as a surprise because we normally think of oxygen as a gas, right? So why don't I weigh less if oxygen is in my body at around, say, 65%? It's not in your body as a gas, is it? It's in your body as water. Okay, and so water is composed of oxygens and hydrogens. In fact, that's what around 66% of your body is composed of, is that water molecule. So that's why there's so much oxygen in your body. Let's talk about the others there. The others include calcium, which are commonly found in what parts of your body?
Bones,
good. Phosphorus with a P is often found in your DNA and molecules like RNA, so it's a component of our genetics. Catch potassium, it has a K for a symbol, okay? That's an easy one to get tripped up on because K is not what you think of when you think potassium. But look who already has P for its symbol, phosphorus, right? Okay, so K for potassium. Where is potassium normally found? Muscles, inside cells, okay? So when we talk about nerve impulses and muscle contractions, potassium is going to be an important one for us to understand. Likewise, sodium has a strange symbol. Its symbol is Na, and that stands for its Latin name, natrium. Okay, it's normally found outside cells. It's also a major player in terms of muscle contractions and nerve impulse transmissions. Some other trace elements include chlorine with the symbol of Cl. That's found in hydrochloric acid. Where do you make that?
Stomach.
Stomach, good. Magnesium is an important one. Magnesium is found inside cells. It also helps cells to relax. If you've ever taken milk of magnesia or Melanta for an upset stomach, yeah, that stuff helps to relax those cells. So magnesium is actually one that helps to put cells at rest. Okay, and we've got sulfur with an S, which also is found as a component of DNA and proteins, things of that sort. Where do you find iron with Fe as a symbol?
Well,
Blood, good, found in that hemoglobin in our blood. And then finally, look, iodine is such a very small portion of your body's content, but oh, you will feel it if you don't have it. Where is this one found?
Thyroid.
Yeah, this is what regulates your metabolism, and boy, you feel like you're just on death's doorstep if you don't have enough of it. All right, so the most common are the top four, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. You'll want to know the symbols for these elements here and a general idea of what they do. We're going to discover what they do throughout both Bio 210 and 211, so it's not like we're going to hit this and leave it. We're going to hit this and use it over and over as we discuss the next few chapters. All right, any questions on this page? All right, if you've got a course pack, let's flip over to page 5. At the top of your page, you have a term called an atom. And it says that atoms are composed, or atoms will compose the same elements. So to flip the wording around, we can say that elements are composed of the same types of atoms. And there's something very special about atoms that helps us to identify which element they belong to, and it happens to be one of these subatomic particles. Let me give you a moment to jot down the particles, their charges, and their locations. Okay, so we all have an ID number, right? You may have a social security number, you have a student ID number, and that number is what identifies us as who we are. In terms of atoms, they also have an ID number. It's the number of protons that are found in that atom. You can change the number of neutrons, and you won't change the element. You can even change the number of electrons, and you won't change the element. But that number of protons that an atom has, that is what confirms for us which element we belong to. So when we go back to this periodic table of elements that we just looked at, you'll notice there's two numbers in each box. Don't get too attached as to where the number is located. Sometimes there's a tiny number on top and a big number on the bottom. Other times it's flip-flopped. But the atomic number, the one that's the calling card for each of these, is the smaller of the two. And that tells us how many protons are in an atom. For instance, calcium has the number 20 there, and that's the number of protons. Every single atom of calcium is going to have 20 protons. Like I said, we can change the number of neutrons, we can change the number of electrons, and still have calcium. But if you change that proton number away from 20, you get a different element. For instance, if you lose a proton, now you're at 19, right? And now you have K, which is which element?
Potassium,
yeah. So those protons are really important because they're the number that drives what element we belong to. So let me help you draw a typical atom. I'm just going to pick carbon, for instance, using this periodic table here. Carbon has which symbol?
C.
Good, there it is. And it's got that 6 up there, so what does that tell us?
Six protons.
Six protons, good. And so where should protons be located in the atom?
Nucleus,
good. We can call it 6P, that's P short for protons. Or if you like, you can call it 6 with a little plus. Because what does the plus indicate?
Positive.
Positive charge, good. To make this fun, I'm going to say that we've got 6 neutrons, which just happens to be the same number, right? Mm-hmm. You could have 7, you could have 8, you could have 5. You change the number, but it does not change the element that we belong to. Okay? So sometimes you may see a little circle there, looks like a degree symbol. That means that the neutrons carry what charge?
Zero.
Neutral. Or none, right, good. So where do they belong in the atom? The nucleus, good. All right, so carbon happens to have 6 electrons, and those electrons are going to be placed on these orbitals around the nucleus. The nucleus is this central portion here where we've got protons and neutrons housed. Oftentimes that is a cluster in the center or the inside of your atom. You'll notice this orbital that surrounds the nucleus is kind of tight. There's not a lot of room on it. And because it's a tight orbital, it only holds how many electrons?
Two.
Yep, so let's place 2 electrons there. This is just my habit. I put a negative symbol and a circle around it. What does that negative symbol imply?
Negative charge.
Negative charge, right. And which particular subatomic particle is negatively charged?
Electrons,
good. And of course, if you happen to see something with a negative there, like 6 negative as a superscript, that implies that we're dealing with those negatively charged electrons. So that innermost orbital is kind of like a sports car. It's really tight around the inside of your nucleus, or around the outside rather of your nucleus. And like sports cars, you can't hold but 2. So any remaining electrons must go on a bigger orbital. So our next orbital, you'll see here, actually has a lot more space. And we're going to place 4 electrons on this orbital. So you may have noticed that we placed 2 electrons in the innermost orbital. That is, in fact, all you can put there. 2 is considered to be the maximum you can place in the innermost orbital. So when you fill up the innermost orbital and you've got 2 there, we consider that you have satisfied the duet rule. How many is in a duet?
2.
So we did. We satisfied the duet rule by placing 2 electrons there. And since we had more to distribute, we spilled over to the next orbital. So this particular atom only has 6 electrons. If you count with me, there's 1, 2 on the innermost, 3, 4, 5, 6 in total. So this next orbital, though, you'll notice is a lot bigger. It's got more room, but it can hold even more than the 4 we've placed there. It can hold up to how many?
8.
Good. And if you put 8 there, we say you have satisfied the octet rule. Okay, 8, of course, being octet. So would you say that we have satisfied our octet rule?
No.
No, we didn't. So how many more electrons could we hold?
4 more.
4 more, yep. So we could place 4 more there until we max out that orbital, and then we would spill over to another orbital. So if you did place another orbital, you would realize it gets even bigger, you know, around this 2 orbitals already in place. That next orbital can hold up to 18 electrons, but it is considered to be stable when you hold how many?
8.
8, right. So from this second orbital on out, no matter how many orbitals you keep adding, 8 is our magic number. It's what we consider to be the octet rule, and that creates a stable atom. I'm going to give you one to try. This one has 13 protons, 13 electrons, and 12 neutrons. Try and draw it out like we did here. Anybody want to help me draw these orbitals? All right, so tell me what to do.
All right, so we'll draw 3 orbitals. We'll start off with the tight one.
Okay, we'll do. All right, so we got 3 orbitals, okay.
All right, so the innermost has 2 electrons.
Innermost has 2, okay.
The outermost is 8. Oh, well, not the other most. The second one has 8.
8, okay. Okay.
And then the last one has 3.
3. What do y'all think?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Look good? Okay. So we satisfied the duet rule,
mm-hmm.
and we filled it up, so we had to spill over, and now we satisfied the octet rule,
mm-hmm.
and we had even more to distribute, so we spilled over to another orbital. This big one out here can hold a maximum of 18, but it's stable when you have only how many?
8.
Did we achieve that?
No.
So we would say this is not a stable atom, right?
It would be reactive, right?
It'd be reactive, exactly. So this one is reactive. Even carbon is reactive. Sure.
Just out of curiosity, in the case that we would have a reactive, would we need to replace any electrons, or they definitely have to stay within their respective rules? Like, say, for the one that we just did, if we wanted to make that stable, do we replace the ones on the innermost and put them on the outermost, or is that not possible?
They're fixed as to where they are in terms of these orbitals. The ones that we can manipulate are only the ones on that outer valence shell.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good question. You're right.
Sure.
So that's a term I want to introduce to you. Valence shell is the name for this outermost orbital. So this one happens to have 3 orbitals. The third one here is considered our outermost, thus we'll call it our valence shell. Okay? Valence just means our outer orbital. just did carbon. This outermost one actually is our second orbital, but it's still valence, right? It's still our outermost orbital. So when we talk about chemical bonding, we only look at the electrons in the valence shell because they're the ones available for transferring or for sharing. Just for fun, this atom you drew had 13 protons. Let's go back to the periodic table. Can you tell me which element this is?
Aluminum.
Yeah, aluminum, there it is, 13. Good. Do you want to draw one more or do you feel comfortable? Okay, let me give you a moment to jot this one down. 14 protons, 14 electrons, and 15 neutrons. Right. So let's take a look. We've got what two subatomic particles set up in our nucleus? Protons and neutrons. Good. The electrons are found scattered on orbitals. So how many of those 14 are placed in the innermost orbital?
Two.
Good. That's it. So we're full. We spill over and place how many in our second orbital?
Eight.
Good. All right, and if you add the total, so far we've got 10 distributed. Looks like we need to distribute how many more on the outermost orbital?
Four.
Good. Would you say this atom is stable?
Reactive.
Reactive. Good. What does it mean to be stable?
Eight electrons.
Good. Eight electrons meets that octet rule. Yeah, we don't satisfy the rule, so we are definitely reactive. What that means is if another atom comes along that's willing to transfer or share electrons, then that happens, and we've got a chemical bond that can take place. So that's kind of where we're paving our way with this stuff. Okay. Feel pretty good about being able to identify protons, neutrons, electrons, all that good stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could transfer, you could share, so however you do it, whether it's transfer or share, if you get four more and create stability, then you've got now a stable atom. Yeah, and that would be the goal. All right, I believe we've hit all of our terms there on the bottom of page 5. Take a look and let me know if there's anything I need to re-go over, clarify for you. So far, so good. Okay. Page 6 takes us just a step further. We've been doing this already. Now we're just going to put a name on it. We are now looking at atomic numbers, the mass, and how to figure out the number of neutrons. So when we're looking at a periodic table, we're looking at symbols and numbers. So let's take, say, for instance, sodium. What is the symbol for sodium?
Na.
Na, good. There's two numbers in the box, and there's a small number and a bigger number. The smaller number is going to be our atomic number. What does the atomic number always tell you? Good, number of protons. What if I added a proton? Would we still have sodium?
No.
Yeah, you'd have something different, right?
Right.
So if we added a proton, we'd actually have magnesium. So that number of protons is very special because it is the calling card or the social security number for that particular element. So 11 protons should be found in every single sodium atom, okay? All right, so if you look at the top of page 6 with me, you'll notice that when the number of protons equals the number of electrons, what do you now have?
A neutral
charge. A neutral charge. Okay, let's put that into practice. Let's start back here with our carbon atom. How many protons do we have?
Six.
Six. How many electrons?
Six.
We also had six. Would you consider this to be a neutral atom?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So neutral and reactive are two totally different issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reactive, look toward that outermost valence shell. For neutral, we look to see if we've got equal numbers of protons and electrons. Good. Let's take this one. We did this one second. It has 13 protons and how many electrons?
13.
Good. Would you consider this one to be neutral?
Yes.
This one's also neutral. Okay. And then the last one we did has 14 protons and 14 electrons, right? Another neutral atom. So we're looking for the numbers of positive and negative charges. If they cancel out, then we consider to have a neutral overall atom. So this one is also neutral. So you may be wondering what happens when they're not equal. If you have an unequal number of protons and electrons, that's called an ion, something we're going to hit in here probably in the next class period. So there's another number in the box in the periodic table. We know the smaller of the two is our atomic number. That always equals the numbers of protons and electrons, assuming we have a neutral atom. In fact, we're going to assume everything off the periodic table is neutral. That makes our conversation a lot easier. That way there's no guesswork into say, well, did it lose, did it gain? Just assume if we're talking periodic table that we are talking neutral atoms, equal numbers of what and what? Yeah, protons and electrons, good. All right, so the other number here to pay attention to is this one. It's the larger of the two numbers. That one's called our mass number or atomic mass number. And that's actually two things added together. What are they? Yeah, protons and neutrons. In terms of their position in the atom, where are they located? Nucleus, good. Hey, why don't we add in the electrons when we calculate the total weight? Have you ever gotten on the scales at home and weighed yourself and you said, oh, that's too much, and you take off something like maybe some jewelry or some clothing and you weigh yourself again and you're hoping for a really big change and it's not? Okay, that's electrons. So if you weigh the atom with the electrons or if you weigh the atom without the electrons, the change is not really that great. So, you know, we don't necessarily include them in the calculation because their contribution is hardly anything. It's like putting on your jewelry, getting on the scales, taking it off, getting back on. There's not going to be a big change in your overall weight. So that's what this number indicates here. It's the number of protons and neutrons. And forget about those electrons. Their weight is negligible in terms of the overall calculation. So here's the catch. If you're given a piece of the periodic table like we have here, what does 11 for sodium tell you? Also tells you the number of?
Electrons.
Assuming that's, yeah, neutral, good.
If you subtract the top of the mass, but it's on the number, you kind of get the number of electrons.
Good, good. Did y'all hear that? Okay, if you take that atomic mass, 23, and you subtract away the number of protons, you're left with what? The neutrons, yeah. So that's going to be something we practice in here. Let's do it the other way. Let's take our carbon atom. What's the mass here?
It's 12.
12, good. Add 6 protons and the 6 neutrons. That's our mass. Good. How about this one? What is the mass here?
25.
Good. Add your protons and your neutrons. And over here, your mass?
29.
Good. So if we simply say that we have 14 as our atomic number and 29 is our mass, then you say, 14 from 29 gives you 15 for the neutron number. Okay. So there's plenty of practice on the bottom of this page where you can go through and get that habit down pat. Okay, so you'll notice down there on the bottom of page 6, you've got numbers 1 through 12. And you've got on page 7 a chart and 18 additional problems to play with. Here's one thing I need to finish up with you for you to be able to do the chart on page 7, and that is this term of isotopes. Okay, so what does iso as a prefix tell us?
Same.
Good. What do isotopes have in common?
Same element.
Same element, good. And if they're the same element, they must have the same number of?
Protons.
Yeah. Confirm that for me. How do you know that all three of these are carbon atoms? I know it's written there, but... 6 protons, yeah. So each one of these has 6 protons. That confirms we're dealing with a carbon atom. So what is different from one carbon atom to the next? Neutrons are different. Good. And if you change the neutrons, do you change the atomic number or the weight?
The weight.
The weight, exactly. So if you take 6 plus 6, that's going to give you a weight of 12. 6 and 7 is a weight of 13. And 6 and 8, of course, is a weight of 14. So these are all isotopes, meaning they're atoms of the same element. They just happen to have different numbers of neutrons. And so that drives, again, of course, a different weight for each of these atoms. So neutrons are what is different from one isotope to the next. We're not worrying about the electrons. That's not our concern right now. We're only looking at the atomic number and if those neutron numbers vary. Okay, I think of these like sisters in the same family. They have the same last name. Their last name's Carbon, okay? And they have just different first names. That's what's differing here. They got different neutron numbers. So when you go back to this periodic table, I did want to show you something. Carbon has the weight of 12 listed there. So what isotope right now is most common in our environment? Carbon-12, yeah. And you'll notice that 13 and 14 are not even on here because they're such negligible isotopes in our environment. When you see points something like 28.1 or 35.5, that's actually how they've calculated all those isotopes. And there's not a portion of a subatomic particle there. All that is they've included the most common isotopes on Earth. So when you happen to see a point something, if it's 5 or greater, we're just going to round up to the next whole number. 4 or under, we'll just roll down to that whole number, okay? So just want to tell you why there's portions or decimal points there on that periodic table. Okay, so what I'd like for you to work on for homework is page 6 at the bottom, the chart on page 7. Work until you feel like you're getting everything right. You don't have to do every last one, just work until you get them right. And there's answers on page 8. What we'll do on here on Wednesday is we'll start page 9, okay? So if you want to look ahead, we're looking at chemical bonds, page 9 on Wednesday. Does anybody have questions about where to go for lab or when?
You said if you have lab today, you would go across the hall, right?
Across the hall, right. And if you've got lab tomorrow morning, it's 8 o'clock, same place, 5405. Okay, if you have any questions, let me know.
Yeah.